I'm Molly, I'm an alcoholic.
You're going to tell me when it's close, right?
Yeah. Okay. Hi, I'm from New Orleans. Area 27, Louisiana. My sobriety date is March 15th, 2005. I thought this was a really fitting topic for me, actually. I'm really glad that I got this one. And there's a couple of different things I wanted to talk about. And I'm really nervous, so don't judge me. I think one of the greatest gifts that AA has given me is an identity and an ability to know who I am, an ability to accept myself for who I am, to even like myself. And that took, you know, a while. It did not happen in my first few years of sobriety, and I've definitely hit roadblocks along the way. But there's a definition of humility that I really like, and it's on page 58 in the 12 and 12, which I think is the fifth step, right? And it says, to those who have made humility, a word often misunderstood, to those who have made progress in AA, it amounts to a clear recognition of who and what we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could be. And so when I think about old ideas, I think about the old ideas of who I was and who I am. And it's funny, I had to make an amends actually yesterday to someone from my past. And I have not made one of those in years. Someone that was like a drinking buddy. And I was really scared to do it. And it wasn't some huge thing, but I made it a huge thing because I'm so different. And he had contacted me on Facebook, and he'd been off the internet or something for, I hadn't been able to find him. And I was so excited he contacted me, and I wanted to make amends to him. And one of the first things he said to me is, I can't believe you're a housewife. And I was like, dude, me neither. And if it's not in my wildest dreams, and if it would have been in my dreams, it would have been a nightmare. So I think, number one, when I came to AA, I did not think that I was an alcoholic. I had been diagnosed a lot of different things. I have a lot of different outside issues in my past, including drugs, of course. And I came to AA, and I was convinced that I wasn't a real alcoholic because when I drank, I always meant to get drunk. I never had the experience of trying to drink two drinks and then beating myself on the head going, how did it happen again? And I wasn't a daily drinker. And now it clearly says in our literature that you may or may not become a continuous hard drinker. So clearly it does not say that you have to have drank a certain amount or drink every day or be physically addicted to be an alcoholic. But it took me a while to get clear on that. And luckily I had a sponsor who was very determined, she's here today, to get me clear on my alcoholism. And this is, I'd been sober 5 or 6 years at this point. And I knew I was an alcoholic at that point. I didn't really know to the level that I know now. So it was, some are slower than others or whatever the saying is. I was a little slow. I came to AA and I had all these, all these identities. And, I'm not going to delve into like a big long drug story or anything like that. I believe very strongly in our singleness of purpose. But I will say my experience is that as a drug addict and an alcoholic, I very much clung to the drug part, and it was so wrapped up in my identity. And the alcohol part sort of took a back seat. So I was very confused by that. And so I had to get clear on that. And luckily, I came to figure out, I came to believe. That I have an allergy and, it doesn't really matter what other things I did. I absolutely am an alcoholic. And it just took a while for me. So I think that was really the first old idea I had to discard, that I didn't fit in or that, it wasn't even that I didn't fit in. It was that somehow I wasn't as bad. And maybe not everybody does that because they have all these outside issues, but we all sort of do that in some way, or a lot of people do. Maybe I couldn't drink. I knew that drinking was probably a bad idea, but really this is my problem, or that is my problem. So I had kind of one foot in and one foot out for a while. And then I really joined AA, and I got a service position in a home group, and I, sort of declared my membership. But I still secretly always felt that my story wasn't good enough, that starting drinking when you're 17 and stopping drinking when you're 19 somehow made me less of an alcoholic than everyone else and something I needed to hide. So I think that was sort of an old idea that I had to discard, that I have a story and I just as much qualify. And nobody told me that, by the way. Nobody said, I spilt more liquor on my tie than you drank. Nobody did that to me, ever. I mean, no, they didn't. But I definitely needed people to confront me on that and say, hey, wait a minute. If you don't think you're an alcoholic, why are you here? You know, this is what forced me to really look at it and look at my actual drinking experiences and come to understand the true nature of my alcoholism. So I think that was a big turning point in my sobriety. I think that was, you know, the first sort of that identity. And I remember struggling very much when I went back to college and all these, you know, girls that were a couple years younger than me and, you know, having the college experience. And I had that and failed miserably. And I didn't get to have that again, you know, not in the same way that they did. You know, I wasn't in a sorority and I didn't live in the dorms or anything like that when I was sober. You know, struggling with that identity. And I remember my first sober New Year's Eve, and I got all dressed up because I like to get dressed up. And I called my sponsor and I said, there is nothing fun to do on New Year's Eve if you are sober. And she said, Molly, if you were drinking, you wouldn't be having fun. And that's the truth. But I struggled with that. I struggled to find peers in AA. I struggled to find people that I related to that were my age, that or not even necessarily my age, that were interested in the same things that I did. And I really didn't know who I was for a long time. And so, of course, I thought that I was inferior to everyone because, you know, that's what we do. So that was my first, you know, sort of foray into, like, figuring out that, like, I have an identity. I don't need to be some kind of rock star. I don't need to be just an alcoholic. I don't need to be just a drug addict. I don't need that to tack on to whatever else, you know, to add to my personality. Like, I can be a person and have a personality and have true friends and have real conversations. And I don't have to have all this stuff in the way, you know, separating me from you. I don't have to be so special. And actually being in service has really taught me how to do that, to be one of many, to not have to be so separate from everyone else. And I think that wasn't, I guess I would call that an old idea that, you know, I'm, what is it they call it, unique, terribly, there's a word, I don't remember, terminally unique, yeah, that was me. And so I guess that's, you know, the other thing I really wanted to talk about, and I'll probably end early, but through my sobriety, I've grown up. I grew up in AA, and we all grow up in AA, really. It doesn't matter what year we get here, how old we are when we get here. But getting married, right, I never thought I was going to get married. I never, you know, I even changed my name, which I was, like, thoroughly against. I recently had a baby, which is not something I ever in a million years thought that I wanted. And I've struggled. I've struggled with reconciling what I thought I was going to be with who I am today. And the truth of the matter is that who I am today is amazing. I have an amazing, amazing life today. And it's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a power greater than myself. But in my head, sometimes I'm like, what do people think of me? You know, like, what do people think? They think I'm like, because I always thought I was some kind of like punk rocker or something like that. And now I'm like a housewife, you know. And seriously, like, I don't have a job. I stay at home. I have a part-time nanny. And I have a baby. And I play tennis. So, and I'm lucky to do. I'm very lucky to do that. And I understand that I'm very privileged. But, you know, I guess the struggle has been reconciling that what I perceive as, I guess, my judgments of those people before, you know, that would be my old idea. Like, look at this woman. Her hair's too blonde. Her tennis clothes are, I mean, she wears too much Lululemon. All that stuff, you know. Like, who is she? I bet she's never had a job in her whole life. You know, all these judgments I had of other people that I project onto myself. So as I've gotten older and as I've stayed sober, every new sort of milestone in my life, I've sort of hit this wall where I have this old, I would say old idea, or maybe this old rule that I've set for myself, probably that I've set for you too, and I have to sort of overcome it. I don't even realize I have these a lot of the time, and I hit it, and I go, why is this so uncomfortable? why am I so disappointed? What am I really unhappy? Is it really okay that I don't have to work? Like, can I be okay with that? You know, I mean, why is that so hard for me to be okay with? Because it's based on all this prejudgment that I have of other people and that I have of myself. So I would consider that old ideas too. Like every time, you know, getting a bachelor's degree, and I have a bachelor's degree in fashion design, and I live in Louisiana. There's not much you can do in Louisiana with that. And I don't know what I thought, like, I was going to do. And you know what? It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do, and I'm glad that I did it, and I needed to be there, and I did it, you know? And I have that skill, and I can use that maybe at a later time in my life. But that's another thing that I've had to, like, reconcile. Like, okay, I don't get to have the career of my choice right now. And that's okay. Just because I'm not running, you know, Vogue does not mean that, like, I'm not okay, or that I've a failure in some way. Like, that doesn't mean that I'm not a success. I guess that's one of the things that I've struggled with a lot, is this idea that I'm a fail constantly. You know, my sponsor calls it damaged goods. Like, you know, I'm damaged goods. Like, everything I do will fail. I'm a loser. All those kind of things that we tell ourselves. And thank God I don't have to live with that today, you know. And as I've stayed sober, it's not so much looking at myself in the mirror and telling me those things like I used to do when I was in high school and I couldn't handle it. And I would literally be like, you're a loser. Nobody likes you, blah, blah, blah. Oh, it was awful. I was like such an emo kid. So it's not like that. It's more under the surface. It's more, you know, I get so, like, nervous because, you know, I'm waiting for something to happen that is probably not going to happen. And I put all my eggs in that basket. And so when it doesn't happen, I'm so disappointed. And I don't know, I've had to realize that. And that's, you know, been something that talking to a sponsor about and working the steps and working with sponsees has really helped me with. And having a home group and being accountable there and, like, being an adult, it feels very strange to me. I'm almost 30. I'm going to turn 30 in September. I'm sure everybody says that. Being a mother, I mean, I'll tell you one of the biggest obstacles that I've had to overcome recently. I have a 19-month-old. These ideas about motherhood. And nobody told me this. I mean, some of it is societal. We could talk about that at another time. But this idea that I have to be happy staying at home with my baby all day long. And I'm not judging people that want to do that, because there are lots of people that absolutely are happy doing that. Me, I'm not. And I took that as a failure. I took that as, I'm not good enough. I'm not, why did I do this? I'm not a good enough mother. And I wouldn't even say this isn't an idea that I had from childhood. Like, this came up. Like, I got pregnant and I was like, well, I don't have a career. I guess I can do this instead. I mean, that's not why I got pregnant. But, you know, I guess I was like secretly, this is a secret, you know, fear that I had. Like, okay, at least no one will judge me because I don't have a job. That's what it's really about. And I'm judging myself for not having a job and, you know, so stuff like that. So I've really had to reconcile a lot of things being a mother. It's definitely, being pregnant and having a baby is the absolute hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And, and so I've had to, like, really, find what works for me and find who I am today. And I can be happy with myself, and I don't have to fit in with a certain crowd or, you know, project some image to you. I can, like, be myself and like myself. And the alternate of that is that I can accept you for who you are, because I can be, you know, just as hard on you as I am on myself. So I'm sure I'm, like, almost done, huh?
Oh, nowhere's near.
I still have 6 minutes left. Oh, I thought you were going to say I only talked for 6 minutes.
No.
Well, you know, I've always heard that, not heard, I've experienced that when you feel like you're done with your story and then you keep trying to add on, like, you end up rambling, so. Thank you.
Thank you, Molly.
I'm Amanda. I'm an alcoholic. Wow. My sobriety date is May 25th, 1995. My home group is the Back to Basics group in Jonesville, New York, at Jonesville United Methodist Church at 12:30 on Wednesdays. So if you're ever up in that area, please come and join us. It's an open meeting. And wow, there's a lot of you here. thank you. Molly, for speaking. That was awesome. I saw a lot of head nods. I saw some tears. And I'm a crier. So bear with me. When I first got this email, one, I don't normally check my emails. So the fact that I saw this email in time is truly, like, divine intervention on my part. And so, yeah, it said, will you speak at this meeting at the International Convention? And I'm like, what? This must be the wrong person. And so, you know, but here I am. And it is truly an honor to speak in front of all you people. So I was like, I don't prepare things like I'm a winger, as I'm going to quote Max there. Like, he's like, I'm like, I asked him, I'm like, did you prepare anything? He's like, I'm like, or do you wing it? And he's like, I'm a winger. I'm like, me too. So that was helpful, you know, and I meditated. But last night I was like, you know, overtired and in my hotel room, and my roommate is sleeping, and I'm like, oh, maybe I should have thought of something. So I opened my non-approved application in my phone and searched for old ideas, and it's in the big book twice, so I was like, okay. And one is in We Agnostics, and, you know, that's one of my favorite chapters, because that's how I came in. You know, agnostic, bordering on atheist. And it's kind of ironic, but it was, I don't even know how many years ago, maybe 7, 8, but I had another spiritual experience when I came to Ikipa here in this town. And, you know, I had been sober for, you know, a while at that point. And one of my old ideas was that I could do this without some sort of higher power. And I realized at that convention that I couldn't. You know, I was raised Catholic and all that stuff. And I know that that works for some people. And that didn't work for me. Thank you. That's my sponsor right there. I should have known when she did the hand signal earlier that I should just say yes, but I'm still stubborn to that point. You know, I was young when I got here. I came in at 21, and I'm going to be all over the place, so bear with me. My train likes to derail frequently. You know, I was 21, and I knew I was an alcoholic. I had known that I was an alcoholic for 3 years before that. I didn't know what that entailed. I was not aware of the allergy. When I got here, I was grateful to have an explanation as to why I was the way I was. But my first sponsor, you know, since I was having such a hard time relating, because I, you know, my first meeting was at 5:30 at this church, and it was all these old people. And I was like, my life is over. And you know, when I had come into the program with the guy that I was cheating on my boyfriend with at the time. And I was like, I mean, honestly, I'm like you. I never thought about social drinking. My idea with social drinking was, you know, there were other people around, and I never wanted in my life to have one or two drinks. That thought, I know, and like I can comprehend that there are people out there who do that and want that, but like I just don't understand it. And so, again, train just derailed, sorry. Having that knowledge, like, was like, oh, thank God. But like, oh, yeah, like, my goal was to be an alcoholic. Like, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a drunk. And I'm going to be that cool mom when if I ever have kids that, you know, oh, I want my kids to be safe and experience things at home. So I will then, you know, do some outside issues with them and get them drunk for the first time. And you know, like that didn't happen. You know, and I thought that I would be knocked up by 21 and that didn't happen either. You know, I had all these thoughts and my first sponsor had said, like, oh, right, I was having problems relating to all you know, old people that were telling me to do things that I didn't want to do. So she had me skip the first 164 pages and jump right to the stories and so that I could relate. And so I thought that those first 164 pages really didn't mean much. Like, they were kind of insignificant. And that is not the case by any means. And it was when I got sober, they just told me, like, don't drink and go to meetings for like a year. And I did get a service commitment while I was voluntold that I would be making coffee at this one meeting. And I did that, and it was scary, but you know, it got me to open up to other people, and then when I started on the steps after like a year, I had no problems with one. Kind of wanted to skip over 2 and 3, and was like, yes, let's do 4. I was excited to do 4. Not many people are. I'm a little different, not really, I totally just wanted to skip over 2 and 3, and she was like, whoa, no. I couldn't really wrap my head around it. And finally, she just said, I was kind of just, you know, like trying to think of what she wanted me to say and saying that. And she said, well, do you believe that I believe that there's a power greater than us out there? And I was like, I believe that you believe that. Expletive. And she said, okay, moving on. And I was like, oh, thank God, that was the right answer. Yes. And I went on to 4 and, you know, continued on and kind of skipped over 11. So I don't know if it, whenever Icky Pot Atlanta was, I was in my teens of sobriety and my life was just, it was unmanageable again. You know, like I went through a phase of not going to meetings and not doing step work, and I don't recommend that for anybody. And, you know, I would occasionally pop my head into meetings just to let you all know that I was doing great and things were wonderful. And I truly believe that the only thing that really saved me was I did service work outside of AA. I'm a member of the Wharf Rats, which are Clean and Sober Deadheads. Yay. And then became a member of the Fellowship. Like, they were not around when I first got sober, which was kind of traumatic, but they did appear, and they follow Fish. And I still help out to this day with them. I'll be at Magnaball. I truly believe that service was what saved me during that time. So here I am with she might have been my sponsor. I think I had finally asked her to be my sponsor by that time. Yes, I'm getting the head nod, yes. So I was with my sponsor and her husband and their lovely daughter, who was just a little toddler. And we went to a 4-step workshop, and I had realized that over all this time of not doing step work that I had all this crap built up. And I started writing. And I saw all these people, like, excited to be sober. And I ended up doing, like, a 5th step with, like, you know, we had adjoining rooms with some other friends and, you know, did that with other people, like, not just one person, but other people. And I truly saw that, wow, God is working in all these people's lives and has been working in my life. Like, my entire life, not just the time where I thought that it maybe was out there. Like, for so long that I thought that he was spiteful and out to get me and didn't want anything good for me. You know, when I learned to love myself in AA, and in turn love other people, And, holy crap. And I finally, like, started to want to be of more service to AA and, you know, got involved with some young people stuff, despite my age, which didn't seem so young. I think, you know, I was in my 30s at that point, and I ended up getting a new home group. I had been liberated of this miserable job that I had for 10 years. And like, you know, prior to that, I had started going to more meetings again and got this home group, and all of a sudden these two people came up to me and said, "You would make a really great GSR for this group." And I was like, "What does that mean?" And so they said, you know, all you have to do is go to this one meeting a month and you can, and just like get the information that they have and bring it back to the group. And that's not the case. I mean, you can do that, but that's kind of half measures, not even half measures. But I found out that that's just what they say to lure you in. And so, you know, I started going to these, you know, district business meetings, and I had always heard that, like, oh, it was all politics, and, like, chairs get thrown at our district, and like, fisticuffs break out, and I was like, that could be exciting. And so I went, and none of that happened. I mean, there was, like, you know, tension when money got brought up, but no chairs have been thrown yet. You know, whatever. I actually went to this GSR orientation that we held, and we had, I'm not sure if she was our delegate at the time, but this woman, Pat, who's the reason why I'm here today, she threw my name in. So shout out to Pat, yay. She's our current area delegate. Area 48, by the way, in New York. And so her and this other woman, Joan, like, shared all this stuff, like, we're the keepers of the traditions, and we're, you know, this and that, and we need to go to area events also, and not just go to one meeting a week. And so I started going to these service conferences like NARASA, and I went to my first NERF this past year, and, you know, I thought that I would be some housewife, and I am not. I am not a housewife. I currently don't really have a job, but I still am not a housewife. I'm a struggling licensed massage therapist, pet sitter, knitter, and basically anything that I can get some money for. Not anything that I can get some money. That is going to sound horrible. Yeah. So we just strike that in from the record. So back to old ideas. Like, I thought that I could do this. I thought that I could do this myself. Like, that I could twist the program to suit me. And, you know, it was written the way it was for a reason. And, you know, and I started, you know, going to all these big book meetings that I used to avoid, like the plague, and go to step meetings, and you know, so second sponsor, current second and current sponsor, you know, whenever I would talk to her about stuff, she would just be like, "Okay, breathe and pray." And I'm like, ugh. Like, were not my favorite words. And for so long, like, I always thought, like, you know, I've been sober this long, like, why aren't people asking me to be their sponsor? And I see why now. I was a train wreck, and you know, even in sobriety, And, you know, when I started hanging out with people that were more living a spiritual way of life and not just, you know, hanging out, like, on the perimeter, and all of a sudden there was this woman who asked me to be her sponsor, and I didn't currently have a sponsor. I was in between sponsors and or self-sponsored, if you will, and I don't recommend that either. So this woman asked me, and I was like, hold that thought. I'm not saying no, but I don't want to be a hypocrite at this moment in time. And so I had been actually, like, for the past couple months, like, trying to think who I could ask to be my sponsor. And, you know, and I'm going through all these women that had more time, and then I was like, nope, none of them. And then I was like, I was starting to go through, like, you know, some of the men that took me under their wing when I first got sober, and this woman just kept getting thrown in my life, like, despite my not wanting her to be there at first. And that's her laughing. And so it finally came to me, divine intervention again, which I was not aware of. I just, you know, I thought that there were a lot of coincidences, and I don't believe that now. And I was like, oh, I should ask Nicole. And so I did. And she said yes. And she kind of looked at, I got the head tilt, I think, like, really? Oh, okay. And so she said yes. And I said, okay. And then I went back to that woman that had asked me. I said, okay, I have a sponsor. I'll be your sponsor. And never heard from her. And, again, divine inspiration, like, you know, my old idea that I didn't have to have a higher power just didn't work. And I was constantly being shown where my higher power was working in my life. And I still, I'm always constantly shown, and, like, I have since had other women, like, ask me to be their sponsor. I have a lot that are, like, you know, sponsor in name only, and I'm okay with that. I just let them know that I'm here if they want to use me. If they want to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I will take them through it. Because that's what a sponsor is. I was not aware. I thought a sponsor was going to hold my hand and pat my back and tell me it was going to be okay and loan me money and all those things that a sponsor isn't. And so, you know, like, all of a sudden these, you know, I had these sponsors or sponsees, and, you know, some of that, like I said, sponsee in name only. And, you know, I don't chase after them. They just know that I'm here and that they can, you know, use me if they want me. I have recently gotten more involved in, you know, service at the district and area level. I joined this ad hoc committee at our district that, you know, we were having, you know, not many GSRs showing up. There was, like, a handful of us. And so I jumped in on the tail end after they did all the work of going out to all these dark meetings and outreaching. And we decided that we were going to try to form a standing committee. And so I was part of the group that formed this service development committee. And I am now chairperson of that committee. And so, yeah, I've gone to these area things and met all these amazing people, and I was reading, I think it was step 12 in the 12 and 12, like, a few months ago, and it was talking about the, like, service proteges or whatever, and I was like, that is not what I want to be. You know, because they were talking about AA meets boy, you know, AA girl meets AA boy on AA campus, and, you know, that's what I had wanted. Like, I wanted to be a housewife. I want to be a mother. And, you know, I'm starting to be okay with, if that doesn't happen, I'll be okay. So this new year, you know, I haven't had a boyfriend. I've been working on me for, you know, like, 8+ years, and all of a sudden, you know, New Year's Eve came, and I helped out at our Alcathon in District 5, And I just said, I decided to watch the musical Rent again, and that song, 525,600 minutes, came, and so I'm, you know, singing rather loudly along, and they talk about measuring in love, and, you know, how do you measure a year, measure in love, and so I decided that, you know, like, the whole, like, searching out never works, you know, So I just said, you know what, I'm just going to try to love as many people as I can, you know, that are in my life now. And this amazing man just came into my life, like, literally days later. I went on my first date with this guy, and he's not in our program. He's in a sister fellowship. So he's, like, on another spiritual path, and it'll be 6 months, which for me, those that know me, that's kind of a record. You know, so in a few days, like, we'll be together 6 months. And the thing that, like, everything, like, anytime there was ever any issue, like, with a relationship, like, I always was like, well, it's definitely something's me. I did something wrong or whatever. And throughout this whole relationship, one, I've been, like, open and honest about how I feel, which is weird and terrifying and also exciting. But anytime there's anything like happening or whatever, or like if there's some issue, you know, he's had some struggles lately, like I realize like it's not me, not my monkeys, not my circus, you know, like, and that is huge. Like, I am not the center of the universe, much to my dismay at times. And, you know, that is a huge old idea that I was not willing to let go of for so long. So, you know, and I feel that God places people in our lives when we need them. And, you know, when all through it, like, I mean, you know, the weekend's just getting started, really. But, you know, I've seen people that I haven't seen in I can't tell you how many years. Randomly, that was air quotes for the tape, running into people on the street or wherever. And, you know, it's just a beautiful God-inspired thing. And my timer went off, so I don't want to take any more of Max's time. But thank you all for being here and bearing with my nervousness.
Once again, the bar is set way too high for the comic relief. So I know she cries a lot, but she puts a lot of funny in there, too. The speakers so far have reminded me of some of those things about my own path in recovery, because, you know, when I got to celebrate my first year of sobriety, I thought I had it. I got this, you know, And I know a lot of people in this room have probably already had their first year of sobriety and thought, yeah, that's it. And I have been amazed on this path how much that has changed. You know, when I finally let go of my last old idea, when I finally did the last one I have in my consciousness, I was 17 years sober. I finally let go of my last old idea. My life was... They told me when I got here, all you have to do, Dave, is change everything about yourself. So I changed all of that. I held on to this, changed all of that. And I just got caught in this spot. And I just thought, what the heck? And then finally, I let go of that last old idea that was in my brain. And my life just went, it's like, wow. And I was like, Amanda, I was just... going along, minding my own business, doing some area service, and then this woman came into my life. I had no intentions of being a house husband. Oh, I'm not. I have a job. But that's not the point. The point is, I had no intentions of entering into a relationship. I'm just finally free at last, and I'm just living my life and enjoying sobriety and doing service work. And I'm at an area assembly, and there she is. My wife of 13 years. It's like, oh my gosh. It's like, that was just bizarre. And I get reminded when And Molly was talking about her degree and how it doesn't really have a lot of use in Louisiana, but I accidentally got a degree that has nothing to do with what I do for work, and my degree is in psychology, and I have a gold mine, you know. But it doesn't apply to what I do for work. The other thing that was interesting for me on this path, because I wasn't agnostic when I got here. I could prove to you that God did not exist. If you had the time, and were sharp enough to follow the logic, because most people can't, you know. And I went to my home group. I was probably 4 months sober, telling them that their effing God doesn't effing work. And I prayed to your God every single day. And they said, well, what are you praying for, Dave, that makes you think this isn't working? I said, I pray for another day of sobriety, just like you guys told me to. And they just looked at me like, dude, you know, what are you missing on this? And that was a long time ago. You know, I have a higher power today, and sobriety has been an awesome path. And the one thing for me that's been incredible is how progressive it is. You know, as I let go of old ideas, sobriety takes another leap. And I let go of an old idea, and sobriety takes another leap. And I talked to my friend Charlie, who lives in Akron. He's 50 years sober this year. And I said, Charlie, does it ever stop? Will it stop getting better? And he said, nope. You stay this path, it will just keep getting better. So I'm going to stop with the comic relief. I know that was hilarious. And bring up Matt.
I gotta get a water. That was just an awkward hug, am I right?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yes.
My name is Max, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Max.
And I am so grateful to be here. And I just want to thank Molly and Amanda for just two amazing talks. And I am so filled with gratitude, I can't even tell you. I want to thank my best sponsee, Vince, for all the New Yorkers that are here today. If you're in New York in November, go to the Bill W. Dinner. He's promoting it. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for asking me. It's an honor and a privilege. And I hope I always feel speaking at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous is an honor and a privilege. If I ever think I'm helping Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in big trouble, you know. But I love, you know, Molly spoke, and I got sober in Louisiana. And my home group is the Harbor Island group in Mamaroneck, New York. Jamie's our cheerleader in the back. She'll sign you up later. We meet four nights, Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. If you're ever in the area, you know, please stop by. But I have to say, I am actually homeless when it comes to a home group at Alcoholics Anonymous. 3 days ago, I moved to Charleston, South Carolina. So, I hope I get to know these people. I love Amanda's talking about sponsorship. So, 3 weeks ago, I celebrated 34 years of continuous sobriety. I was four when I got sober. They asked me to speak down in Texas once. I was like 12 years sober, and I was like, how long do I speak for? They're like, an hour. I go, I got sober when I was 15. They're like, well, just tell the whole story. And I was like, in first grade, you know, like, you know, 45 minutes into it, they're like, you know, it was a men's meeting, and you know, they're like, crap, get out of the eighth grade already, you know. But, you know, I tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. She's talking about sponsorship, but I started sponsoring people when I was 17 years old, you know, and thank God for the topic of old ideas. I was outside with my buddy Mark, who I got sober with, who's here today, who also got sober young. I got sober with a ton, by the way, and I want to put this out there. I got sober with a ton of people who got sober young and are still sober. And these people, I guess. And the reason we're sober is we did the steps. It's that simple. There is no other reason. You know, I speak a lot, and a lot of times when I speak, the first question in open discussion meeting is, how did you know at 15 to get sober? Like, what in you, you know? There was nothing in me. I wanted to drink. That's constantly. My mom, who's here today, my hero in my story. On my mom note, the last time I was in Atlanta, I was coming off a month ride drunk. And she was so angry with me, instead of flying me back to New York, she put me on a bus from Atlanta to New York just to punish me. But My mom was 3 months in Al-Anon and threw me in rehab, so Al-Anon works too. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started sponsoring people when I was 17 years old, you know? And I love what she said about taking people through the steps. That's my job as a sponsor, not to do anything else. I was 17 years old. I was sponsoring a guy who was 35. He was like, I'm having problems with my wife. I was like, leave her, you know? I was like, you know. He was like, Max, you know, works really hard. I was like, quit, you know? Just make sure you're at our meeting Friday night, you know? But, you know. But I always say that, but, you know, somebody came up to me recently after I spoke, and they're like, was there really a guy, you know, and his name was Bill, and he's still sober? You know, because I had been through the 12 steps, lined out in the big book, I could sit down with a man at 17 years old and go over to A-Step with him and help him make his amends, and he ended up moving from our area very shortly after that, but that's what the steps do for us, you know, and that's why I'm living in Charleston, South Carolina, because AA is huge. Look at this. You know, first, just for the tape, where there's about 20,000 people in this meeting. This is my fourth international convention. I do love it. For those that knew Frank M., who was big on anonymity, by the way, so forgive me, Frank. He really was. He used to say, it's half our name, so we should take it seriously. But Frank was a hand putter-outer. Now, my sponsor, Pete, who took me through the steps, when I got to the 12th step, he would never talk to me after meetings. He'd make me put out my hand. You know, my sponsor, Clancy, if anybody knows him, he's helped a couple people. So if you want to stay sober, it really, you know, sponsoring's a good way to go. Put out your hand to the newcomer. And I was told today there was somebody here celebrating a year from Jersey. I want to say congratulations, you know. And I guarantee if there's a guy in this room who's a month sober, he can hear that guy a lot more than he can hear me. So please go up to the new guy, you know. So, you know, I'm not going to go into my drunk log. I was talking to Mark outside the meeting, you know. In a way, it was like a layup topic, you know. You know, old ideas is everything, you know. It's like, that's the program. Sandy B was a, you know, amazing Alcoholics Anonymous member. And he has tapes, and you can hear him and all this stuff. And I knew Sandy, and I loved him. My mom knew him better. But one of his talks, he says if he was asked the two words that summed up Alcoholics Anonymous, he would say, let go. And it was like, yeah. I mean, so when I got this topic, it's like the first thing I had to let go was my drinking. Okay? My mom was living in New Orleans. About 6 months before I got sober, I was on my seventh Bloody Mary at a tugboat thing at about 10 o'clock. There was this party at 10 o'clock in the morning, because that's when they have tugboat parties, I guess. And my mom finally said to me, because I guess I was drunk enough, she's like, hey, can I have a sip of your Bloody Mary? And I was too drunk to say no. I was like, yeah, Mom, here. And it was, you know, and she didn't like the fact that her 15-year-old son was drinking vodka, you know, Bloody Marys. And she started crying and yelling, why are you drinking? At 10:30 in the morning, I remember just saying, I can't wait till I'm 18 so I can drink legally. And you get, you know, that's all I wanted to do. Because I had something broken in here. And I didn't have any, I had something broken in here, not because my mom's not an alcoholic, my dad's not an alcoholic. My parents got divorced when I was 7. I came from a loving home. My mom loved me to death. My dad loved me to death. My grandfather, who died of disease, who is the nicest guy I ever knew, loved me to death. So I didn't have this big horror story that I drank it. If anything, I had too much attention growing up. My sponsor says to feel normal, he needs to be treated special. That was me, you know? Because when I wasn't treated special, I felt so less than. But something broke in me, and I needed to drink. I needed to drink by the time I was like 8. Now, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I completely respect the fifth tradition. But I'll just give you an idea of how much I needed to drink. When I was about 9 years old, somebody told me if you took pine needles and put them, you know, you'd get high. Well, okay. So I took some pine needles, I put them in some toilet paper, and it just blew up in my face. But I was willing to be an alcoholic, you know? I just, you know. And, you know, my grandfather drank a bottle of vodka every day. And, I mean, I watched him do it, but that's what Gramps did. It actually didn't make a huge impression on me. My mom lived with a man who was an alcoholic, and we had a cabinet full of alcohol. And it was definitely a different time in the 70s, and I could drink. But I had to let go of alcohol. My mom put me in treatment on June 16th, 1981. And I had a pajamas on and my loafers. You know, that's who I was. I was like, I was going to let you know who I am. You know, I'm from the Northeast. You know, I just come from boarding school. You know, you can put pajamas on me, but I'm wearing my loafers, you know. But, I didn't want to let go of alcohol because that hole in me, alcohol filled it up. It made me look at the world better every time. And, I say that, but about 6 months prior to me getting sober, I started to try to get sober, you know, on my own. I couldn't do it. I'm going to stop drinking. I couldn't do it. But the only reason I'm sober is because I got into the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. So the first thing I had to let go is alcohol. And the only reason I'm sober is because it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. That's it. If it said you have to admit you're powerless over alcohol, you know, I'd be dead. You know, I got to jump right to a vision for you where it says, you know, are we going to be resigned to a life that's boring and glum? Well, I was 15 years old. That's all I thought. I was like, are you kidding me? You're going to take alcohol away from me? I'm going to be resigned to a life that's boring and glum. And that has been far from the case. You know, my sobriety has been fun. I've done everything sober. You know, I've gone through all kinds of changes. But when I first got sober, the idea of staying sober forever just freaked me out. I was about 3 months sober, still 15. I was just about to turn 16. And a guy told a story who was 45, who seemed like he was 80. You know, when you're 15, guy's telling a story, he was 45, seems pretty old. And I was sitting there like, no way I can do this. And that's when somebody was like, it's a day at a time. And that's how we do this. We do it a day at a time. So that, you know, that happened. And then, you know, I came to believe that a power greater than me could, you know, help me. And I had a very strong spiritual experience early on. I'm not exactly like Bill, but very intense. But just like Bill, and it was enough that I could do the third step and get on my knees and turn my will and life over to God. You know, and that was then I had to let go of that. And my thing with the third step, I didn't have a problem with God. My mom, I was not raised in a religious home. My dad was very Christian. I still had no religion. So I didn't have a fight with God. But I had a fight with alcoholism. So if God forbid I'm turning my will and life over to God as I understand him. But I did, because I got the second step, I got on my knees. And it was enough that I could write a four step, an honest four step. And do a fifth step. But after that, you know, I think the most thing about the letting go of old ideas is 6 and 7. It's huge. You know, my creator, I'm now willing that you have all of me, the good and bad, that you now take every single defect of character so I can be of use to you and my fellows. I mean, if that's not a new idea, holy crap, you know, I only thought of myself. I was so self-centered. It says in our book, the selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem. My second day in treatment, they put on a jackboard, you know, I, self, and me, ism. And I was like, uh-oh, you know, that's me. You know, what was I going to do? But I went through the 12 steps, and, you know, I did the 8 and 9 step. And what I really want to talk about is 10, 11, and 12, because that's where I've lived for a long time. You know, I've continued to take my personal inventory. The 10th step lets me continue to do the, you know, 4, 5, 8, and 9. Keep them in my life. That's the way I look at it. You know, I'm really 1 and 2. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol. I was talking to Mark before. I really believe if I was to drink after this amount of time, I'd have to accept one of two thoughts. One is, I was 15. I was too young. I can totally drink normally now. And a lot of people drink on that assumption. Or, I don't give a hoot. I got to drink. I am so much pain, I'm drinking. I know what's going to happen. And I've known and seen too many people in our recovery, that's exactly what they went out on, those two thoughts. And because I work a program, because I get on my knees every day, because I call my sponsor every week, you know, it's amazing. So I got sober. I was a member of the world famous Mamarna group. Ray O'Kay was the, you know, our guy. And, you know, I got to a point in my sobriety where I was in the best AA group in the world. We know the best. We do it the best. If you do it different than us, you guys don't know AA. You know, and that's an old idea, and it's a really self-righteous, unhealthy place to be in sobriety. And I was like 4 or 5 years sober, and I had a nervous breakdown between my 6th and 7th year, about 5th and 6th year. And my group, Harbor Island, got formed. How much time do I have?
Good.
So my home group got started, and thank God, it was really a spiritual experience that Harbor Island got started, because like Amanda, I became the first GSR for the Harbor Island group. And I got to go around to the assemblies, I got to go around all the New York area, and I'd see how amazing AA was all over the place, you know? And I got to meet Frank. So as a GSR, it was not once a month. I was like, yeah, I'll do it. I probably would have gone up there. Yeah, you know, if they were like throwing chairs and stuff, I'm like, let's go. But it wasn't like that. But it was an exciting time in Westchester. We started the first Joe and Charlie Big Book Seminar ever in New York State, which was an exciting time. And that was exciting. And then I became a Big Book expert. And then I said, you've never met any of those, have you? So people love that when you just, you know, lay it out for them. Tell them they don't know anything. But I love the Big Book and I love the 12 and 12. And I just want to put that out there. You know, in the 12 and 12, in the 12th step, I have so many thoughts, by the way, I want to say. So this is one I really wanted to say. Through my years, even doing service and all that stuff, I had relationships. I did the whole first year thing. I was 15. I wanted to do nothing more, but I put AA first. And I'm big on that, okay? But that's me. So, but relationships, I got way dependent in relationships in my sobriety. And an idea that I had to let go of was that they're not the higher power. There's one who has all power. Bill B., who is a member of AA in New York City, I was going through a relationship breakup, and I was just devastated. And I'm like 10 years sober. 12 years sober. How could this girl who's 3 years sober break my heart like this? How could she, right? And he takes me to the diner and he said, well, it sounds like she's your higher power. I was like, Bill, I've done all the work. What do you mean? I know what a higher power is, you know? And he says, well, your higher power is the thing you think about the most. And I was just like, phew, you know? Old idea, you know? And it was true. And I could grow. And if I didn't go through that work and do the Big Book work with Frank M., and I were doing a lot of Big Book studies in New York City at the time. And Frank's whole thing was God. If you're having a problem with money, you're having a problem with sex, you're having a problem with work, whatever it is, God's big enough to handle it, whatever it is. And, you know, because of that work, I could meet my wife and marry my wife. An old idea. You know, treat women with respect. You know, my wife is my partner, right? She's not my servant. You know, I am a typical example. A guy needs something done at a meeting, cup of coffee, no problem. My wife's like, Max, can you clean the dishwasher? I'm like, what? You know, don't you know who I am? You know, it's like, I'm speaking at the International Convention. my poor wife, by the way, is back in South Carolina alone. And she's amazing. But she really is. She's a saint, for sure. You know, and she taught me an amazing lesson on that. I want to tell you that. So I'm all about AA, and I'm all about God, and I'm all about putting God first and AA first. But I don't need to tell my wife that. I don't need to tell my wife that she comes third, you know? And she told me that once. She said, you know, Max, that might be, and that's great, and I'm going to let you do all that stuff, but I don't need to hear it, you know? I need to be first, and she is first. And she gave me two amazing girls, you know? I'll tell you a quick story. My oldest daughter, so funny. I swear to God, she was 9 years old. She was doing some Girl Scout stuff. And I take her out to lunch, and I said, honey, my sponsor Clancy's, he's celebrating 50 years. Do you know why? I was like, do you know why I'm going out to L.A. this week? She's like, no. I was like, because my sponsor hasn't had a drink in 50 years. And she looks at me deadpan. She goes, is he really thirsty? Yeah. It was the cutest, beautiful thing. And she, you know, she's 16 and hasn't had a drink. I was 3 months sober when I was 16. So it's an amazing thing. You know, again, back to old ideas, staying teachable, remaining teachable. You know, my sponsor's been on a kick lately about remaining teachable. I need to remain teachable. I need to go to meetings and not think that I know everything, that I've heard everything, and that I don't need to, you know, put my hand out to the newcomer. I've had God shots after God shots. I was down in the city recently auditioning for the Bill W. Dinner. And New York City. And the last thing I want to end with is I got very active in my, when I first got sober, you know, it says in There Is a Solution that we should be open to religion. You know, it doesn't say to be closed off to religion. It says be open to religion. And I was like, oh, man, those people at church are so fake. They're a bunch of losers. AA is the only place to go, blah, blah, blah. And in the last 10 years, I got very active in my church. I was an usher. I was a greeter. I was a Sunday school teacher. I was a deacon, and I was a Stephen minister. And partly why I got so involved with my church was because that's that, but AA is this, and it never took me away from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to say that's an old idea. If I go get involved with this, I'm never going to be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That wasn't the case. So I'm down auditioning for the Bill W. dinner. I look up the street, and there's this woman coming towards me. I'm like, she kind of looks familiar. It was my minister from my church. And that's when for me, when I'm open and I'm doing 11-step like I did with my friend Deb this morning. She had chakras and stuff this morning. I don't know what was going on in our hotel room. We were meditating. It was amazing. I'm open because I want to be open to the simple message of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like it was when I got here. And the simple message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the way I understand it, and the way my sponsor tells me, is one alcoholic helping another alcoholic to help that alcoholic do things that he would never do on his own. And that's it. So I just want to say, if you're new or you've been here a while, please stay open-minded. Please keep putting out your hand. I just want to say how fun it was speaking with these amazing... I can't wait to get the CD so I can actually hear what they said. I just want to say, I love to everybody that's here, and thank you, everybody. Thank you so much.